afternoon. Do I come across in the back? Is this okay? Is this the right level? Okay, that's better. Okay. Maybe the PowerPoint should come up. The music came up, but... While the techie sort out my left hand. As I speak, you will notice a certain accent. That accent comes from my mother tongue, which is Flemish. And Flemish is the Dutch spoken in northern Belgium. And so you might wonder what entitles me to address this audience. I've worked in agriculture since 1976. Amongst others, I've worked at Monsanto and I've traveled literally all continents. Whoop-de-doo. There we go. Traveled all continents. And basically the last couple of years, government agencies, companies, and farmers organizations pay me to think about the future. That's why I'm here. Now there's another reason why I'm here. And why I enjoy being here. I would ask you to consider me an in-law, and I'll explain that to you. I married Sally. She's the daughter of a Rocky Mountain cattleman. My father-in-law did not sell animals for meat. He sold bulls for quality stock. His first operation was in Buffalo, Wyoming. And last operations, which he sold a couple of years ago, were in Boyd, Montana, between Billings and Red Lodge. Sally paid for college, of course, at Montana State in Bozeman, with a good sale on a calf her dad allowed her to choose. We named our youngest son Percy. And for the old-timers amongst you, that's in honor of Judge Percy W. Metz, who presided over court almost for half a century in Dayton, Wyoming. Obviously, all this doesn't make me a rancher, but I told you, consider me an in-law. So, here we go. If I look at the beef value chain, it's pretty obvious that a lot is changing. And we'll talk about the big changes that are happening in the world and how it affects you. Then I'll talk about how the industry is reacting. And finally, I'll talk about some of the technologies and elements that are coming and that might help you, or that at least you should be aware of in the decisions you're going to make in a couple of years. So I'll start my talk very broad, starting from the world and gradually moving to Montana, Nebraska, Wyoming, and Colorado. first slide, why do all these companies give in? Why does McDonald's suddenly worry about quality of life of animals? Why does Kraft suddenly want to reduce the sizes of their portions? Is all this an overreaction, or is it simply the fact that Altria, the parent of Kraft, learns what it costs or what it can cost to fight public opinion, because Altria also owns the cigarette company Philip Morris? Walmart has told the industry shape up, and even Frito-Lay, which I wouldn't say is not necessarily health food, has committed to launch a new range of snacks which are lower fat. So, what does all that lead to? Let's look at BAT, bovine, spongiformic, encephalo, whatever it is, BSC, mad cow disease. In 2001, the U.S. tested about 7,000 bovines for BSC. In 2002, the U.S. tested 20,000 bovines. Great. We're making progress, aren't we? Now, let me wake you up. Europe tests 20,000 bovines per day, and Japan tests every single animal that enters their food chain. So depending on your perspective, yes, we're making progress. On the other hand, there's a long way to go. Let me talk about five fundamental challenges that agriculture faces, and we are part of agriculture, and we will have to cope with those challenges in the long term. Water, manpower, economic power, demanding consumers, and politics. Water. This is the, you'll see the map, it's a sequence of the drought monitor from USDA. The western U.S. remains in a drought alert, and many pockets range from extreme to exceptional. And don't tell me that the 4 inches of snow of yesterday will change that fundamental problem. The issue of water was discussed at a conference last year in Des Moines, where we compared water in the U.S. with water problems in the Middle East. Today we have shortages in dry areas. There is competition from lawns, there is competition from recreation, the boats, and there is competition with energy, because electricity partly depends on water behind dams. By 2010, there will be shortage of water in all highly populated areas in the world. And by 2020, there will be a global water shortage. One country except Canada. They're the only ones that have enough water long term. Just think about it. Issue of manpower. There is obviously reduced availability of manpower in the third world because of urbanization, graying of the operators, and then in Africa, for example, the natural and human disasters like hunger and AIDS. But if I look in this room, it's clear that there is not a very strong urge to repopulate the plains. So there is maybe an issue of manpower here as well. And then the whole the industrial supply chain is sucking people out of the agricultural supply chain all over the world, maybe in this part of the world as well. There's the issue of shifting economic powers. There's a concentration in the food chain that happens in agriculture, in the transformation industry, processing, and in marketing. There's the power of retailers, and Walmart, I'll give you more details. At this point in time, agriculture only captures 15% of the value the consumer pays for food. If we sell $1, the consumer pays $6. There's an issue there. We have lost out on power, leverage. At this point in time, about 50% of the money spent on food in the U.S. is spent out of the home. People don't even buy food anymore. They go out or take out. All that changes the relation we have with our ultimate consumers. So one way or another, we have to reintegrate or integrate further back into the food chain. Power has shifted, I told you before. The world's biggest company today is Walmart. It sells, last year it sold for $244 billion, of which $54 billion in food. There are 1.3 million employees at Walmart, of which 300,000 outside of the U.S. Every week, 180 million people visit a Walmart store. And in January 2005, Walmart will demand its 100 biggest suppliers to put RFIDs on their boxes and on their pallets. The power has shifted downstream. Let's go even further downstream. Consumers. We've heard about creating added value, etc. But to give you an idea of how complicated and how difficult it is, consumers want healthy food. The problem is, what is healthy? So here you have a certain number of criteria, like low fat, low cal, no additives, no sugar, all natural and organics. Those are all healthy things, right? So in 1993, these are the number of products that were launched in each one of those categories. For example, 847 in low fat, and about 385 in organic. That was the situation in 93. Now we go on further in 97, suddenly it's all low fat, and nobody cares about low sugar and no additives anymore. Then in 2001, everything switches back. The low cal drops out and is now all natural and organic. And what is the fad in 2003? Tell me. I hear low carb, right? In beer, in food. I saw salmon, smoked salmon, low carb. Why can't we sell beef low carb? So the point is, if you want to get closer to the consumer, you better be close with him, because he has a tendency to change his mind every 2-3 years. And if we want to get closer to our consumer, we better shape up and get the feedback mechanisms in place. Okay, food politics. Origin affects the freedom and the cost of products worldwide. Cultural sensitivities affect food choices wherever you go. And I always say, in audiences like this, there are countries in the world that don't eat pork. There are countries in the world that don't eat dog. And believe me, there is a country with 1.1 billion people in this world that will not eat beef for cultural reasons. And you will not change that. That's the subcontinent of India. So it's all a matter of perspective. Governments want to protect and want to be seen supplying cheap and quality food for the masses in every country in the world, whatever that means. And then there is the recent concern about tampering and bioterrorism. So all these things play into the decisions that are made and that might not necessarily come across rationally where we are here on the foot of the Rocky Mountains growing our cows. And to give you an idea about sometimes absurd timing coincidences, within 1 week, in January 2002, both the European Community and the Congress of the United States wrote almost identical laws coming from totally different political perspectives, identical laws to enhance the quality of food and to secure the food health and security. Within a week, 23rd of January, 28th of January of the same year. So it is not just them Europeans, and it is not just them Congress in Washington. the whole world tries to solve the same problem at the same time. So, and we have spoken about it, we've heard about it this morning, about the emerging food regulations, about bioterrorism, prior notice rules, COOL, the country of origin labeling, field security activities, and then traceability strategies. All that will hit us. Maybe we can fight some background battles, but it is coming down the pipe. It is too overwhelmingly needed for our food security, the food that you and I and our kids eat, and we want that to be secure, wherever it comes from. Okay, food companies. Those big names, the Nestlés and the Krafts and the Conagras and the Cargills, they want to protect their franchises. They want to protect their brands. And to do that, they will impose quality standards upstream. And they will do that directly themselves, either... I went too fast here. I have to go back. There we go. So they will get it done directly through contracts or through intermediaries and agents. And I'll give you an example. Cargill, very big company. Cargill is $55 billion sales. It's the biggest private company in the world. It had recently fully integrated the orange juice chain and its baby food chain, which means that it can trace back every single ingredient in baby food from the little pot you buy down to the field where, or the barn where it came from. They have done that for oranges. They have done that for baby food. And to achieve that, they have converted or built new elevators to store that identity-preserved food. Now, if you look up there, there is Cargill XL, boxed beef. If Cargill can and wants to do it for oranges and baby food, they have the capability to tell you guys, I want identity-preserved beef. And if it's useful and profitable for them, they'll do it. Now, there is an issue. In this country, fortunately, the business culture favors entrepreneurship, bilateral contracts, and competition over cooperation. And unfortunately for us, the financial markets do not see agriculture as a growth opportunity. So whatever innovation and new technologies we implement, it'll have to come out of cash flow. That's important. That's limitation. We also face certain obstacles to change. Very often, and that's very particular in our industry, there are adversarial or zero-sum thinking in the value chain. Whatever dollar you make, I lose. That's not necessarily the case, but that's the way the thinking still goes. There are still inefficiencies in the food chain that are accepted as the cost of doing business. It's always been like that. I can't change it. Well, you can change it. And it's difficult to change the behavior of the participants. Well, of course it's difficult, but you can. Another point is that very often what changes in one part of the value chain will impact other parts of the value chain. So whatever you want to change, it is not necessarily going to be easy. So there is built-in inertia in the system. And we will have to cope with that inertia. But change will happen. It will happen incrementally. It will happen as new infrastructure gets built. It will happen with specialty markets. And we've heard this morning about very good examples of specialty markets in beef. And will be enabled by the cash flow generated by this new value we create. So, summarizing the introduction. Agriculture and the beef industry will grow food with less resources than people. We'll sell food to fewer and more oligopsonistic customers, and I'll tell you what oligopsonistic is. We will make food fit increasingly demanding and diverse consumer needs, and we will operate with less clout leverage and political protection. You all know about a monopoly, right? A monopoly is a company that dominates selling something. A monopsony is a company that dominates buying something. So what we in the beef value chain are confronted with is not a monopoly of people that sell to us, but an oligopsony of a very few people buying from us. Let's have the words right. We're not confronting a monopoly. Okay. So, confronted with all these issues, how can we possibly confront that without using our brains or developing the right strategies? It's pretty obvious that doing the things your dad did was not going to help us very much in the future. So let's look at the future. Technology has always been eagerly adopted by agriculture, and so let me give you some recent examples. Barcode scanners, the clean cut and bagged lettuce mixes. There is a supply chain management which keeps our food fresher, better tasting. Upstream there is the IPM, Integrated Water Pest Fertility Management, improved genetics and biotechnology. There is the automation of field tasks, and there is precision agriculture. And precision agriculture, you might have heard about it, but to give you the latest things to put in perspective, currently there's about 50 million acres that are harvested with yield monitors, and 15 million acres that get variable rate treatments. 30% of the acres in corn and soybeans are now in a regimen of precision agriculture, about 10% of wheat, and since 2 years the adoption of cotton has increased tremendously because they have now harvesting technology, harvest monitors for cotton. We see expansion happening in precision agriculture and large animal confinement system to manage the byproducts, and that is happening already in hogs and in the pork chain. For example, in Missouri, the biggest hog breeder in Missouri manages 20,000 acres to get rid of his byproducts. Rangelands, too bad to avoid the problem of overgrazing. It's obviously it's a very good technology to manage the land aspects of livestock operations, not necessarily the breed or the herd aspects. It's pretty obviously used very strongly in California on irrigation to manage water better. Maybe we can use it to better manage our water. It has allowed certain crops to reduce manpower costs. And it's pretty obvious that in certain rural, suburban confrontation zones, like I call them, having the data to prove that you did things right might help the farmer in his battle against the school district, for example. Another technology that's important is wireless. And one of the different crops that have gone totally wireless. One example is wine, for example. There's several wine estates now that have equipped their vineyards with wireless technology connected to the central computer. And everything that happens in the vineyard goes back to the computer. There are now trucks that have radios and transponders. The Le Cultural Ag Show in France last year had a wireless network that connected everything and everybody. You could walk in there and log on high speed to the internet. Same thing happened at the Info Ag conference this year in Indianapolis. And so think of a scenario where within 2 or 3 years, every vehicle, every animal, every piece of equipment on a farm or on a ranch is connected by radio to the network, to the database, and that everything that happens is recorded automatically. And I'm saying deliberately 2, 3 years. Okay, one of the elements that will help make this happen is RFID, radio frequency identification. They're basically small devices that can store and send data. Sometimes they can receive data. They sometimes have read-write capability, sometimes read-only. Ruggedness is not an issue, and costs are coming down. The chip itself costs now about 5 cents. Sometimes putting the chip or ruggedizing the chip costs more than the chip. And I picked up over there in the exhibition hall a couple of examples. They're here. That is not way out. It's over there. You can buy them right now. The RFID is another example of very rapid civilian adoption of a technology that was proven in the field by the military. And the previous one was GPS. GPS was used tactically by the military in Gulf War I. We had the first commercial agricultural applications 5 years later. RFID was first military tactically used in Gulf War II for dog tags in the Navy. All the supplies for the entire army will be RFID'd by 2005, and that includes food. So it's pretty obvious that the clock starts ticking, and it's very likely that it will not take 5 years for RFID to enter agriculture. Let's take some example of where RFID is implemented right now. In 2003, Gillette bought 500 million tags to track their Max 3 shavers. Procter & Gamble will implement RFID in 2004. Every single piece of equipment that Air Canada owns is tracked by RFID. Luggage handling in Las Vegas, Brussels, and Stockholm Airport will be on RFID anytime soon now. Ford's engine plant in Windsor, Ontario. Every Michelin tire that will come out will have an RFID. There will be an embedded chip that can tell the whole life of that tire. In retail and services, I talked to you about Walmart, but there are examples of libraries, grocers. It is happening, and it is happening very fast. Even in agriculture, there are RFID examples. There is the animal ID systems in Greeley, Colorado, very prime, which was spoken about this morning. And then there's the issue of the European Community Research Center. They tested between 1998 and 2001 on a lot of cattle from birth to slaughter, and that included 440,000 beef. And basically, they did it in different countries. They tested three different tags, the injectable tag, the digestive tract tag, and then the ear tag. And after all that test on 440,000 units of beef, the EC, the European Community Research Center, says, this thing works. Go for it, industry. You have our blessing. That was 2 years ago. So it works. It has been proven in large-scale tests in beef. Let me scare you even more. No, that's not the intention. We all know about technology cycle. And the classic model of a technology cycle is where a technology gets adopted, reaches a peak, and then gradually erodes out because there is a new technology that comes up, and then that gets popular and disappears, and then a new technology takes over. And we were used over the years of gradual substitution of one technology by the other. An example was very gradual substitution from wind to steam and to diesel. And usually that took a generation or 20 years. We had the time to learn and to adapt. Unfortunately, in technology, the things change. In the high-tech model, there is what I would call time compression. So instead of having a regular transition, you have now much faster and exponential transitions. And a typical example is Intel Pentium 1, 2, 3, 4, and now we go to the next one. So it's pretty obvious that confronted with all those technologies coming from other areas of industry, we have to ask ourselves to keep our sanity and to put things into perspective and think in cycles. When will you buy your next truck? When will you buy your next phone? When will you buy your next computer? That's the kind of cycles you have to think about. What you also have to think about is who will buy your cars in 2004? Because you better work for his or her requirements. How many technology cycles will we go through between now and the year 2010? 2, 3, 4? Have you opened enough space in your brain to handle that? Which cycles will you participate in? You as a person, you as an operation. How prepared will you be when New Zealand Lamb and Tyson Food, our biggest customer, put RFID tags on their shipments to Walmart? How prepared will you be when Argentina beef effectively complies with Bioterrorism Act traceability requirements? How prepared will we be when chronic wasting disease becomes a household word just like BSE? Let's look at it positively. Quality. Consumers pay for quality. Customers pay for quality. And as we have seen this morning, quality means profit. Unfortunately, quality just doesn't drop on you. It's not something that comes from the preacher choirs on Sunday. Quality is hard, hard, hard work. Quality can be measured tangibly. Quality requires a repeatable process and predictable results. And quality requires upstream and downstream traceability and documentation. So let's talk about quality. We all know the aspects, the tangible and the measurable aspects in the beef chain. The genetics, the grid, dogs, the weight, consistency. We know that. We may be less aware about the issues of process and result. Process always requires formal planning, the recording on what actually has been done, the tracking of the results, the analysis of deviation, and a feedback loop to start all over again, and you do that 2-3 times a year. What is very important as well, if you talk about a value chain, is that not one single link is not limited to one link in the chain. All links in the chain have to comply, otherwise the chain breaks down. And that's what we talk about. Quality ultimately will be the result of a process. And you can ask, can that be done in our industry? Well, there are other people that sell meat that have been there and have done that. Some examples. Salmon since 5 years. Salmon is now farm-raised. It's no longer fished. Hogs, 15 years. That industry is now different. It is another industry, perfectly controlled. Poultry, we know it. They told us the lesson, didn't they? And then kosher. Some people do it for 2,500 years. So it can be done. You can have quality chains from the animal to the consumer. Fully integrated, fully reliable, everybody trusts. High value. It can be done. Now I'll talk about documents and traceability. And yeah, that's an issue. Do we have to do it? It's a pain. I know. On the other hand, I've been thinking to give you some practical guidelines. Okay. This little thing, that notebook, will do if you have a handful of units. If you ledger a bigger book and tags will do for the foreseeable future if you have a few dozen units. A PC and an Excel worksheet will probably cope if you have a few in the low hundreds. Once you're in the mid or high hundreds, Excel won't do. You better have a real database and you have a real computer, preferably connected with backups and the whole thing. Once you're beyond 1,000 cows, and once you are part of a special value or a highly integrated chain, think RFID. Because the data requirements that will be imposed on you, never ever you can handle it with this, never ever you can handle it with a PC. You will have to automate your data gathering. Okay, so now is the time. I was asked to talk about the future. The future is now. Now is the time to enjoy the prices.
before they self-destroy. Sorry, shouldn't say that, but we all know they will self-destroy.
Now is the time to invest in cost reduction so that you're better prepared for the next downturn. Now is the time to invest in quality so that whatever the economic situation, you always get more than the average. Now is the time to integrate into the value chain. Stop selling commodity stuff. Sell the best of the best. Be the Lexus. Don't be the Chevy Cavalier. So, this is my last slide. Think food, because we are supplying food. Think lots of food. We're an industry. Think quality. Quality pays. Quality means profit. But if you have to think proof of quality, that means a process, that means documentation. And in the current environment, think security and think proof of security. I don't think we can escape on that one. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much.